My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schreyan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
We go straight into round one, which tests their vocabulary. And for 2 marks, what's the dictionary meaning of these words? We begin with Frank Muir. Frank, yours is bumble puppy.
Bumble puppy? Well, it's the fruit of mating a bee with a Great Dane. There aren't many of these around. Or it could be...
Please.
I can't really do this as writing. A game.
Yes, what kind of game?
Well, when I was a child, my father erected a tall pole in the garden.
Yes.
To the top of which a string was attached.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the string, there was a little tiny net in which was enclosed a tennis ball.
Quite right. What did you do?
Two people played. One person stood on one side and one on the other. And each of you tried to hit the ball. And the one who wound the string round the post first won.
It's a very accurate description to listen. And you get 2 marks.
And the Great Dane, I presume, retrieves the ball.
Batted with both front paws. But just for completeness, it also can mean any game. It could be whist or tennis or billiards or even Ludo that is played in a thoroughly unscientific and amateur fashion, not very well.
Only way. Game's worth playing, it's worth playing badly.
I agree. Anyway, they get their 2 marks. Anne Scott James, yours is a placebo. Placebo.
Well, it's the sort of pill you take when you're about to listen to the news. It's a comforting pill or draught.
And should it comfort you?
What do you mean, should it?
Well, what's it got inside it?
Oh, yes, that's right, of course. It's when some tiresome old lady goes to the doctor and has a different complaint every day, that's right, he gets fed up with giving her real medicines because she doesn't need them. And he gives her a bottle of pink stuff.
That's it.
Or a blue pill, and that's a placebo. I forgot that aspect of it. And he keeps her quiet without her, in fact, taking a drug.
That's it. 2 marks. Dennis Norden. An ichneumon, ICHNEUMON. And if you're terribly pedantic, you might call it ichneumon.
Jack, I give you my word, as true as I'm sitting here, that word and I have never met. I don't think we've even passed on the street. It's an entirely unfamiliar shape. It looks as if it means the same thing backwards as it does forward. I don't know whether that's... Is it Ich Neumann? My name is Neumann.
Is it in the ichthyosaurus class?
To do with fish? Is it it's from fish?
Well, it has to do with crocodiles, if you regard a crocodile as a kind of a failed fish.
That's very nice.
Could you regard me as a kind of failed panelist?
Come on, it's animal.
Well, it's animal.
It's animal, that's right.
And it's to do with crocodiles.
Yes, it's
a kind of nightmare situation. You find yourself broadcasting to millions of people all over the world about something to do with crocodiles. I've never studied in any depth.
It even steals into crocodiles' mouths when they're gaping and eats their bowels, which is a rather nasty thing to do.
I'm now absolutely positive I've never come into contact. There's a bird that flits about on top of a crocodile. That's all I know. Sum total of crocodiles.
Cleans its teeth. My grandson, aged 6, at the weekend, what was his favourite dish to eat?
Yes.
And he said, shark-infested headmaster.
I'm going to give him half a mark for that. We're not going to get any more. It's a weasel-like animal, rather like a mongoose, found in Egypt. and they used to like it because it fed on serpents and on crocodiles' eggs. But then they got a bit elaborate in their imagination, as I say, thought it crept in through the crocodile's mouth and ate its stomach for it. And also it's short for the ichneumon fly, which is an insect which is parasitic on or in other insects. Half a mark would be fairly generous.
Not generous.
Well, now, Dilys Powell, it's your turn, and your word is kismet, K-I-S-M-E-T.
Well, kismet is the name of a musical play. It means fate.
Yes.
In some Eastern language, I think.
Yes.
Arabic?
Arabic will do.
Arabic will do.
It's Turkish, but it comes from the Arabic. All right, on there.
Delightful.
And it means destiny or fate. It's a staple of the theory, the godly theory, as it's called, of predestination. And it means that which divides, I mean, from good from bad and lucky from unlucky and so on. It's also been suggested that when Lord Nelson was dying, he didn't actually say, kiss me, Hardy, but kismet, Hardy. It meant he had his chips. 2 marks. Well, at this point, I give Dennis and Frank a quotation each to think about for their stories in the last round. And Dennis, yours is, cast thy bread upon the waters. And for you, Frank, a thing of beauty is a joy forever. Mm. Well, now we test them further. And this is a round of origins and derivations. And for 2 marks, I want to know how the following words or phrases originated or from what did they derive. We begin with Frank Miller, most appropriately, an apple pie bed.
An apple pie bed is one of those frightful sort of boyish japes whereby, as I recall, you fold the undersheet halfway down over so that the bed is in effect only half as long.
Yes.
And the rest of the bed resembles an ordinary bed. So the victim, as you lie secreted in a cupboard or something, gets into bed and then can't get down the bed. And you tee-hee-hee-hee-hee in the cupboard. It's not my pleasure, but I presume it's wrapped over like an apple turnover.
That's a good point, but it is wrapped over, but it isn't originally in the English language. If you cross the channel, you may get it.
Apple pie.
No, you're going east. I want you to go south.
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 Well,
French.
South. Yes, France, yes. If you think what French for a sheet is, may help.
Dra.
No, not a curtain, more than a sheet.
Yes. Well, we have curtains on our bed.
I'm going to give you 1 mark.
What a rubbish. It's an apple pie bed made from an apple turnover.
No, it isn't. It's a corruption of the French, nup, pli, which means a folded sheet, or if you want to be very pedantic, nup, plié, a folded sheet. And then when you crossed the channel, it became apple pie.
Well, I lose cheerfully, but I don't agree with the answer.
All right, we pass on. Anne Scott James. Under the auspices of my origin.
Well, the auspices were the auguries.
Yes.
In Roman times.
Which kind?
Oh, they're looking at the birds.
That's
then.
What I wanted.
The birdies, whether they came in from the they got a right and left. You know whether.
Exactly right.
A bird on the right was
lucky.
Lucky, and a bird sinister was very unlucky.
Yes, auspex in ancient Rome was a chap who observed the flight of birds and interpreted the future by watching those flights. Unlike the chap who looked at entrails of beasts, that was called a haruspex. And only the commander in chief was allowed to take the auspices of the likely result of a war. And if then one of his subordinates, like a brigadier general, gained the victory, he was said to have done it under the good auspices of the commander-in-chief. Well, now, Dennis Norden, a bowler hat.
Do I define it?
You can define it first. I want its origin after.
It's a head covering, rather dull, except when in the hands of Laurel and Hardy, who use them like a virtuoso violinist uses a violin. Now, the origin of the bowler hat. Would it be too much to hope that it would be a man?
Yes.
called Sir Adolphus or Charles, or I'm willing to temporize on the Christian name, something Sir Something Bowler Hat, who wanted something where he could protect his head and keep his sandwiches at the same time, while in the saddle.
That last bit's absolutely right. Leave out
which last bit?
The one about keeping his head protected and possibly his sandwiches too, while he was riding a horse. Yes, that's right.
I was watching the Derby.
Well, but leave out the hat. And who was the mister then? If you give me that, I'll give you your marks.
Well, if it wasn't Mr. Hat, would it be Mr. Bowler?
Oh, no.
Mr. Bowler.
There was a Mr. Bewley, or the Oxford Dictionary says Bowler, who was a man who made hats in the 19th century, and a very famous landowner, William Coke of Norfolk, asked him to design a hat with a lower crown than the top hat, which was always being swept off his head when he crossed under branches when he was out hunting. And so it was invented in order to be less vulnerable than the top hat. 2 marks. Andilis Powner. Ragtime.
Ragtime is a form of music which originated, I should think, early in this century.
Yes.
It was very ragged.
Yes, hello. Yes, you've got it all. It's an abbreviation of ragged time, syncopated tempo, first, I think, introduced in the first 10 years of the century by various musicians, and one of them was Scott Joplin, but perhaps the most celebrated instance is Irving Berlin's Alexander's Ragtime Band. 2 marks. Well, now we have a round of misquotations, well-known sayings that have, over the years, become, in most cases, only a little changed from their original form. And so for 2 marks, I want to know what was the original wording of the following quotations. Frank Muir, if the mountain won't come to Mahomet, then Mahomet must go to the mountain. I think it's a rather cheating one, but you can try.
It wasn't Mohammed, it was Charlie Palmer.
It wasn't even Charlie Chaplin.
If Charlie Palmer would come to the mountain. No.
Yes, think of synonyms.
Yes, I'm thinking of them. He wrote the May Gray story.
Thank goodness.
His wife, Antonym. synonym.
Four.
Four. Ah, it's the mountain.
Yes.
Hill.
Can't be.
Yeah, yes,
if the mountain won't come to Graham Hill, then Graham Hill.
All right, I'm going to think that you really have got there between you and your partner. Now, in Francis Bacon's essays, and it's an essay, rather surprising, on boldness, the original quotation is, if the hill will not come to Mohammed, Mohammed will go to the hill. I get you 2 marks. Well, now, Anne Scott James is very much more up her street, I think. First, catch your hair.
Thought that was right.
Yep,
that was right.
Not at all.
Well, first catch your rabbit, it ought to be.
No, I won't do.
A rabbit being slightly smaller than a hare, just as a hill is smaller than a mountain.
No, we're on the wrong tack.
Well, there's a whole book, a cookery book called First Catch Your Hare.
Yes, there was.
So the whole book.
Incorrect.
Wrong.
So the whole
book. The whole book is wrong.
I wouldn't say that. The title is.
It's a classic cookery book. Very good one. Can you give me a hint?
Well, it comes from somebody called Hannah Glass, who existed a long time before Mrs. Beaton, around 1747. And it's a rather difficult verb, which is...
Is it one word that's wrong, or the whole thing? Cockeyed.
It's got to be a longer quotation, which is really abbreviated into first catch your hair. And
first you must lay your hands upon the beast you wish to kill, cook, and eat.
Yes,
what
you
do better if it's a hare.
What you do
better it should be a hare.
What you do before cooking it?
You pluck it.
You skin it.
You skin it.
That's what I wanted.
You skin it. First skin your hair.
You defrost it.
Oh, but you said it's got to be longer. You defrost it, that's it, yes.
I'm going to give you 1 mark, a lot of help there. The original phrase is, take your hair when it is cased, and cased meant skinned. It comes in a book called The Art of Cookery, written by Hannah Glass in around 1747. 1 out of 2. Dennis Norton, A poor thing, sir, but my own.
Yes, an ill-favoured thing, sir, but mine own.
And where? This is not necessary, but...
No, I'm not doing it, it's not necessary. Well, this money, I'm going to plug myself...
It's
Shakespeare. Is it As You Like It?
Yes, absolutely right. Yeah. 2 marks. It's Touchstone in Shakespeare's As You Like It, an ill-favoured thing but mine own, and he's speaking very impolitely about his girlfriend, Audrey. 2 marks.
It's probably an eel-flavoured thing.
And now to the spa. Here we go gathering nuts in there.
That can't be wrong.
No.
Well, it's very wrong. You'll try it.
June.
Well, no, even October. Even October, yes, that'd be about right.
October would be right.
Yes, but what are you gathering in May?
Gathering in May, flowers.
Yes, what kind of flowers?
Flowers. Oh, May.
Blossom.
Monocilla.
That's what I wanted.
Blossom.
Uh-huh. May blossom.
That's what I wanted.
May?
Yes.
Maybe.
But what would it be if it weren't nuts? I mean, try a little more. If it weren't nuts, have a word like nuts, but not quite.
Nuts.
That's what I wanted. All right, 2 marks. Here we go gathering nuts in May, though a children's song is a perversion of here we go gathering knots of May, which is an old custom of picking knots or bunches of May off the hawthorn tree on May Day, if they were there. Well... Now we come to the last round, and we go back to those quotations I gave Dennis and Frank at the beginning of the program. And for this round, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Dennis, your quotation is, "Cast thy bread upon the waters," which comes from the Bible and is in Ecclesiastes, or the preacher.
Cast thy bread upon the waters. I'm not generally much given to biblical quotations, but I did once happen to find myself uttering this. It was at the top of my voice, in pyjamas, at 3 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of my garden, during a heavy rainstorm. My daughter, you see, was going through a phase. The phase was where she filled the house with pets. Small, greedy, highly perishable pets. We had furry creatures who specialized in burrowing, feathered creatures who specialized in fluttering, and finned creatures who specialized in dying. Now, in fact, where tropical fish are concerned, no zoologist has ever satisfactorily explained why it's always the 10p one that eats the £3.50 one. But where other fathers would come home of an evening and say, "What's new?" I used to come in the front door and say, "What went?" So finally, I put my foot down. Look, I said, surely there must be some domestic creature which has a better chance in the actuarial tables. I mean, what is small, inexpensive, doesn't bite, and has some kind of lifespan? Well, I don't know how warmly you feel about tortoises, but quite apart from the fact that they look like peripatetic tin hats, in the pet shop they really were an unappealing sight. There was a whole load of them together in one glass case, and they spent all their time crawling up and over each other very slowly. It was like an orgy in an old folks' home. Nevertheless, we bought one, took it home, released it in the garden and watched it walk away. Have you ever seen a tortoise walk? A tortoise walks, it always seems to walk like its feet hurt. But we stood there watching this one move off across the grass, then we went back inside for lunch and had to search for a whole 5 days before we found the damn thing again. 5 days during which my daughter developed such
acute anxiety and grief. She got a temperature of 103. She was determined not to let it happen again. So what she did was she got one of those ring screws, those small ring screws, and she screwed it in about an eighth of an inch in the hard shell, the middle of the hard shell on top of the tortoise. Then she got a fishing pole, fishing rod, and stuck it in the middle of the lawn where Dillis's dad used to put the mumble puppies, remember. And on this fishing reel was about 200 yards of nylon thread. And she then tied the other end of that nylon thread to the small ring screw on top of the tortoise, you see. And that way, the tortoise had complete freedom to roam the whole garden if it wanted to. But any time she wanted, she only had to reel in the thread, and there was Romeo and Juliet. Well, she called it that because it's very difficult to tell the sex of a tortoise, so she wanted to cover both eventualities. Anyway, that was that, and we got her to bed, panic over. And that night, however, up came this rainstorm, and I went into the garden in the dark, in my pajamas, in the pouring rain, dashed across the lawn, splat, right into that nylon tripwire. Have you ever hit a solid stone gnome nose first? So it was that, as I mentioned, then, at that moment, as I rose to my feet and tottered to my daughter's window, I let my voice rise to really biblical intensity. Blast thy thread upon the tortoise.
I think Dennis will be in trouble not only with the RSPCA but with the NSPCC as well. But we go on at that point to Frank. And if you remember, his line was, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever," which, as everybody knows, is the first line of Keats's Endymion. Frank.
"A thing of beauty is a joy forever." I said this morning while I was shaving. I didn't, in fact, say it to myself. I said it to my wife, because she had miraculously produced a present for a chap in the village called Arthur Watkins. And I couldn't think of a present for him, and my wife managed to do so, because Arthur Watkins is an old-age pensioner, and he loves tea, and he spends his retirement in dispensing tea from an urn at the Thorpe Village Dramatic Society intervals. There is Arthur with a tea urn saying, "The cup that cheers but does not inebriate, sir," to everybody, including the ladies. And he's a terribly nice chap, and we wanted to give him a present. But what sort of present do you give a chap like that? Present choosing is terribly difficult, isn't it? I think one of the reasons I'm terribly glad that I was born a peasant and not a member of the royal family is the thought of every Christmas having to give the Queen a present. I mean, what would you give? I suppose once in a while you'd find some newfangled thing like a corgi cozy. But then, how would you follow it the following year? The whole business of Christmas presents all started very early in our household, and centre claustrophobia has got a grip. And but it isn't really the Christmas presents which are the problem, because we're going to give the whole village copies of the book that Dennis and I have just got out. I didn't, in truth, mean to give the whole village a copy, but I rang up the publishers, Matthew, and said, "I'm going to be rather courageous and order some copies of our book." So the chap the other end said, "Very good, sir. How bold are you?" And I thought he said, how old are you? And I said 54, and we got a rather large number of copies to give away. So the same with Arthur Hopkins. You know, he'd have a copy of our book for Christmas, but what to give him for his birthday? And then this morning, while I was shaving, my wife suddenly produced a little jar or jug or some sort of china container with sort of rather pretty Indian painting on it. And on the side it said, pure Darjeeling tea. I said, you can't give Arthur that. He spends his whole time bent over the urn. And my wife said, yes, but he loves tea, and he spends his time bent over the urn, sniffing in this steaming smell coming up like boiled old football boots. And afterwards he's allowed to take home and drink the tepid deposit at the bottom, 50% tannic acid. He's allowed to keep everything below the tap. But this, and I suddenly realised my wife was right, and I said, you are so right. I mean, a little jar of that stuff would be nothing to many people. But in the words of Keats, a thing of pure tea is a joy for Arthur.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, Dennis Norden just wins the story, but Dillis Powell and Frank Muir win the entire contest.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.